For millennia, Jews had a story about where they were in history. And tonight, what I want to do with you is to highlight how America changed that story. Years ago, I remember sitting with an Israeli colleague who was describing her encounter with the children's book, Rivka's First Thanksgiving. The book was written in 2001, but it's set in 1910 in the United States. And it tells the story of a 9-year-old Jewish immigrant who is persuading her family and her rabbis that she should be allowed to celebrate Thanksgiving, which she learned about in school. And in response to the elders' resistance, the young girl says, first source on your outline sheet, "You do not seem to understand that immigrants came to America to escape from mean, wicked people who hurt them and their families. That is why the pilgrims came, and that is why the Jewish people came later. The pilgrims were thankful, and I think that we should be too," signed by Rivka Rabin. My Israeli colleague said that upon reading this book, something clicked for her that she had never understood before. For American Jews, the United States was the promised land. Not just another diaspora to ride out, not a Gentile government granting them more favorable terms, but a kind of different end to Jewish history. I felt at the time, and still feel, that this was an overstatement, especially of this children's book, but the reaction stuck with me, and it did capture something deep. Because Rivka's letter in this book indeed presents herself as a modern-day pilgrim, seamlessly integrated into the story of America. And it made me realize how much I, personally, never thought of myself growing up as a Jew who happened to live in America. I thought of myself as a Jew and as an American, and I never imagined it any other way. And so as we're gathering tonight to reflect on the upcoming United States sestercentennial, I want to revisit some obvious truths about Jewish life in this country, ones that we take for granted, but should not. And I want to think about how the Agadah and Halacha of American Jews has been upended by our experiences here. And to reflect a bit about what it will take for us to invest in the next chapter of a robust Jewish life in the next quarter millennium. America upended our Agadah. For millennia, Jews saw the world fairly simply. We were exiled, dethroned, left to the whims of nations that cared more or less about our well-being, and we were riding out the storm of history in the Ark of the Covenant. Eventually, at the end of time, all that would end, balance would be restored, the world made right again. Until then, things would be out of sorts. At times oppressive, at times thriving, but always out of sorts. For a long time, this was not only the Jewish understanding of the Jewish story, it was the Jewish narrative of the entire universe. V'ha'aretz hayta tohu vavohu, v'choshech al pnei tehom, v'ruach Elohim merachefet al pnei hamayim. The earth was wild and waste, tohu vavohu, and darkness over the face of the abyss, and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. Breshit Rabbah reports that Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish interpreted this verse as referring to the exiles of the Jewish people. And the earth was tohu. This is the Babylonian exile. As Jeremiah says, "I looked at the earth, and behold, it was tohu. Ra'iti et ha'aretz v'hine tohu." And vohu. This is the exile of Media, Persia, as it says, "Vayavhilu lehavi et Haman." They hurried, "Vayavhilu," like vohu, to bring Haman. "Vechoshech Zegalut Yavan, darkness, the exile of Greece, which darkened the eyes of Israel with its decrees. Al pnei tehom zegalut mamlechet harisha'a she'ein lahem cheker kemo atehom. Over the face of the abyss, this is the exile of the wicked kingdom, Rome, which cannot be fathomed, just as the abyss cannot be fathomed. Just as the abyss has no bottom, so too the wicked have none. Beruach Elohim merachefet, and the Spirit of God hovered. This is the spirit of the Messianic King, as it says, V'nacha alav ruach Hashem, and the Spirit of God shall rest upon him. Four kingdoms, four eras of time. The narrative of the world was one in which Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was followed by Babylonian exile, Persian anti-Semitism, Greek erasure of Jewish identity, and finally, Roman subjugation, rendering the Jews a disfavored minority in a sprawling and seemingly unending empire that eventually became defined by the worst dynamics of supersessionism that Jews could have possibly imagined. As Christianity and Islam came to dominate the world in which Jews lived, we just saw our new hosts as nothing but the continuation of this fourth foreign kingdom of Jewish history. We remained firmly ensconced as second-class citizens with periods of greater and lesser privilege, and we would remain so until the Messianic Age. We were not of, and we were alienated from, the systems that ruled us. The Mishnah in Avot instructs us to pray for the welfare of the government only because without the government, the Leviathan state of nature would eat us alive. And we dutifully prayed in our synagogues, Melech Malchei Amlachim, Berachamav Yitein Belibam, Uvelev Kol Yoatzehem, Visarehem, La'asot Tova Imanu, Ve'im Kol Yisrael. We asked God to imbue the hearts of the sovereign, of which we were not a part, to deal kindly with the Jews. All we could do was to ask for kindness and to wait for the fourth kingdom to fall. Then came the European Enlightenment, which offered a new look at old conventions. Religion began to be dethroned. Science took its place as the way to make sense of the universe. A notion of human equality began to spread. Monarchies start to yield to republics. Revolutions sweep governments away. And in all of this, Jews saw great promise and began to realize great benefits. But European emancipation was often encumbered. In France, to take one example, the Jews were admitted to the new republic as full and equal citizens, but provided that they renounced any notion of being a separate people. They could be Frenchmen of the Mosaic persuasion, but not an Am of their own. Jews could transcend their history of oppression only by transcending their historical understanding of who they were. In other countries, Jews only fully experienced emancipation through baptism, which was described by Heinrich Heine as my ticket of admission to European culture. Ultimately, no amount of enlightened thinking was enough to flush the supersessionist toxin out of the body of Europe. Bundist Jews who sought refuge and prosperity via solidarity with other working-class Europeans were ultimately overwhelmed by blood-and-soil nationalism that always relegated the Jews to being foreigners on another's soil. And the Holocaust was the final act in that play. It was a culmination, if you will, of the cruelty of the Fourth Kingdom. Zionism's insight was to realize that this is where it was all heading. And that Jewish movement retained, and in many ways still retains, the worldview of the four kingdoms, asserting that the only Jewish refuge from history is an end to history, a messianic age that undoes what came before. But America was different. The founders of the United States were interested not only in reforming their old nations, but creating a new one. When in the course of human events, it became necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which had connected them with another, they did not simply splinter into new kingdoms and duchies perpetuating old patterns. They played with new ideas in a new world. They held certain truths to be self-evident, among them that all men were created equal, that governments derived their just powers from the consent of the governed. They asserted that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. Particular governments were now seen as means rather than ends, tools of history rather than its inevitable features. But even more important and dramatic, the Constitution of the United States was free of any particular religious character. For the first time, Jews lived in a society that did not tolerate them. It included them as true equals. Article 6 miraculously states that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. The First Amendment miraculously states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And the 14th Amendment later incorporated these guidelines and applied them equally to all of the states. This new reality was summed up for Jews in a powerful and well-known exchange between Moses Satius and George Washington on the occasion of the latter's visit in 1790 to the Newport Synagogue, where Satius served as a sexton. Satius reflected on the Jews' experience of their four-kingdom history and just how different America was. He writes, "Deprived as we heretofore have been of the invaluable rights of free citizens, we now, with a deep sense of gratitude to the Almighty, disposer of all events, behold a government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance, deeming every one of whatever nation, tongue, or language equal parts of the great governmental machine. Like much of the lofty rhetoric of those early years, we can look back with some degree of facility and see the promises not fully fulfilled, those who were not completely included in fact in these promises. But return just to the moment of the idea and the revolutionary spirit that was getting this exercise off the ground, and listen to how Washington answers it, echoing back Satius's language and underscoring that Jews were not tolerated by Americans, they were Americans, just like any other faithful citizens. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it were the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support." But perhaps even more significantly, because America was fundamentally founded on an idea, as a set of principles, as opposed to the notion of a reformed government for an ethnic group living on its land, it never demanded that the Jews purchase their equality at the price of their collective identity. Jews and other immigrant groups were assumed to be able to hold fast to the ideals of America while also supporting aspirations for their respective homelands and by building pockets of culture with the fellow members of their minority group. No oath of fealty to the fatherland was required. We were not expected to be simply Americans of the Mosaic faith. And as Washington himself blessed the community in that same letter, "May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid." the stock of Abraham could live on in America as the stock of Abraham. The price was simply to be good citizens and to show fealty to the Constitution, just like everyone else. American Jews hold these truths to be self-evident, but they are anything but. America is in many ways a modern-day Rome and drew inspiration in its founding from that ancient empire. A version of the Roman eagle adorns our currency, sits as a finial on the top of our flags. But this country for the Jews has never been Mamlechet HaResha'ah, the wicked kingdom. It is not even accurately described as a Malchut Shel Chesed, a government that is kind to the Jews. Rather, it has simply been, in a completely unprecedented way, a country in which Jews are full and equal citizens. And it created a culture in which Jews were no longer waiting for the last exile to end. They were no longer waiting for the fourth kingdom to fall. America offered an exit ramp from that highway of history, and it changed Jewish life and consciousness and our Agadah forever. But America has not only changed the Jewish narrative, it has had a deep impact on our nomos as well. Our halakha looks different because of our time in America, particularly as we became more integrated into American society. Some of the story of normative Judaism in America is a typical modern one. Same questions played out in post-emancipation Europe played out here. The proposed answers were not always that interestingly different. There were pressures to make accommodations around observance, and there were pockets of cultural and religious resistance to the same. But some challenges are more distinctly American. How to pray for the government when you are as much a part of it as anyone else? Dozens of prayers have been written for American synagogues that try to capture this new ethos. The halachic category of Krovei Malchut entertained leniencies for Jews who needed to walk the corridors of Gentile power. In a democracy where, as de Tocqueville put it, the people are the real directing power, should we be lowering barriers between us and our neighbors in order to promote Jewish interests and a functioning democracy? In a society where we see ourselves and our neighbors as shared citizens in a shared political project, Talmudic laws that distinguish between Jews and Gentiles on matters of safeguarding property and life are not just reputationally embarrassing, they become conceptually incoherent. Those who live in a world in which all are created equal, and that is self-evident, will need readings of Torah that don't fly in the face of this fundamental commitment. But more than any given particular, I want to suggest that the most distinctive aspect of an American discourse of religious norms stems from the ease with which Judaism can be modified or abandoned in America. In Europe, emancipation often presented a stark choice. You remained within the traditional Jewish community, or you found ways to assimilate outside of it. But American Jewish life had entirely different dynamics. America offered citizenship to Jews and to other immigrant and religious groups as a pathway into a society that would be defined by its citizens without any government involvement in promoting dominant forms of religious or cultural expression. And what that wide-open environment meant was that American Jews have the untrammeled freedom to intensify, attenuate, or remix their Jewish commitments as they see fit. Yes, Jews were not always broadly welcomed in all social environments in America. The city and others are full of institutions whose origins lie in the social and professional exclusion of Jews from professions they ultimately often came to dominate. But the fundamental vectors of American society always pointed towards our inclusion and to an inertial baseline lack of distinction between us and our neighbors. Sociologist Charles Liebman long ago pointed out that all Jews in America are Jews by choice. Nothing in American society truly binds you to your Jewishness or expects you to maintain it. Yes, family pressures are real. Insular communities can often effectively coerce people to remain within them. But Jewish life in America plays out in an unpressurized cabin, even if Jews find ways to put on their own oxygen masks. And all of that means that Judaism in America has had to cultivate a Judaism that one would choose, or what we call in rabbinic parlance, avodah me'ahava, service that flows from love, not from yirah, from fear, pressure, or a sense of having no alternative. Service that flows from love has always been the gold standard for our tradition of mitzvot, and it is hard to achieve. Here's how Maimonides sums up and codifies that prized disposition. Ha'oved me'ahava, osek b'torah uv'mitzvot, v'holech b'intivot ha'chokhma, lo mipnei davar ba'olam, velo mipnei yirat hara'ah, velo kedei lirash hatova, ela ose ha'emet mipnei shehu emet, v'sof hatova lavo biglala. If you serve out of love, you engage in Torah and mitzvot and walk in the paths of wisdom, not for any worldly reason, not out of fear of harm, and not in order to inherit the good. You do what's true because it's true, and the good will ultimately come on its own account. This level is a very high level. Not every wise person merits it. It is the level of Avraham, our father, whom the Holy and Blessed One called Ohavo, lover of God, because he served only out of love. And it is the level commanded by the Holy and Blessed One through Moshe, as it says, Ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha, you shall love the Lord your God. And when a person loves God with the proper love, he or she will immediately perform all the mitzvot out of love. Rambam here emphasizes the unusual nature of religious commitment that is maintained for no reason other than conviction and enthusiasm. Most people, even among the wise, even among the chachamim, will not attain this level. But those who do reach the level of Avraham Avinu, who under no duress other than the longings of his heart and the searchings of his mind, sought out a new path that would bring him purpose and meaning. Jews in America are often preoccupied with demographic continuity and our checkered attempts to push those indicators in the right direction. That's reasonable. It's even necessary. But I want to suggest to you that the same America that attenuated commitment, that led to skyrocketing intermarriage rates, that has stagnated natural Jewish population growth, that same America forced us to have avodah me'ahava. So defining of American Jewish life is this simple fact. People only do it because they want to do it. This is maddening for rabbis and educators. It is exhausting when you are recruiting people to come to events like this one. It is inefficient to the point of insanity when it feels like you have to subsidize, entice, and seduce people into participating in Jewish life, and when attaining commitment is itself unattainable. But for those who do stay, for those who do show up, for those who do invest, it produces something remarkable. Jewish life that is embraced for its own sake because people have determined it is truly better than the alternative. America has correspondingly forced us to speak about mitzvot less as a yoke and more like a magnet or a compass. It moves us from a discourse of guilt and loyalty to a discourse of aspiration. it pushes us to call people out less for their deviations from the lines that we toe. And instead, we are best served when we call people in for the opportunity to build something together. You cannot imagine this Beit Midrash, this yeshiva, without America. I don't mean just the egalitarian space that reflects the way feminism impacted and shaped 20th century America, left its impact on the workplace, the academy, and the halls of power. I mean its more fundamental character. We are proud and enthusiastic about observance. We see mitzvot as opportunities to build something extraordinary. We believe that halacha must make sense and must be something you can explain to others. We believe that the discipline of Jewish life is ultimately about manifesting values that we care about. Our normative discourse here is not one that takes anything for granted, because as American Jews, we know you cannot take anyone for granted. It is a place grounded in avodah me'ahava, the joy and love of serving God, the Torah, and the Jewish people. And for that, we have America to thank. Now, you can be, as I am, appropriately grateful and clear-eyed on what America has meant for the Jews without being Pollyannish. It's a tough time right now. We may approach the 250th anniversary of America with joy, but it's a fraught moment. The country is divided. In many ways, it is deeply pessimistic. Recent polling showing that clear majorities have little to no confidence in national news media, Congress, and the federal government. And pride in being an American has been steadily sliding downward in the last 15 years. As Jews, we're confronting realities we thought would not manifest again in America. Surges in anti-Semitism that are measurable as separate from anti-Israel activism. A retreat in certain quarters from Christianity's 20th century reorientation towards Judaism reached its apex with the Second Vatican Council, and now seeing a reversion from its more ecumenical formulations to the supersessionism of old. There's a resurfacing of socialist ideologies that technically have space for Jews as faith practitioners, but revile their collective efforts to live as a sovereign people. There's an end to the bipartisan consensus around Israel, with a specter of bipartisan support for spurning the Jewish state. These are all real. My kids are growing up in a world very different than the one that nurtured me. I know enough about history not to pretend that I know the turns it will take. As a grandchild of survivors, I will never assume that any time or place is an impregnable fortress against the forces of hate that can wipe out places of Jewish flourishing. But as an American, and as a student of Judaism in America, I do not, cannot, and will not classify America as simply the latest manifestation of the Fourth Kingdom. Americans can be anti-Semites like anyone else. Americans can be cruel and wicked like anyone else, but America's DNA is different. I was recently reminded of President Clinton's wonderful line in his first inaugural address, "There is nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America." This remains true. It remains true. Even after all we have been through in recent years, even as we live in a country where 44% of people feel they don't share values with other Americans, even as people are increasingly afraid that the other side of the political divide not only disagrees with them, but is coming to take their country away from them, the ideals on which America was founded, the Constitution that continues to govern it, these remain pathways to achieving human dignity, to respecting human equality, to protecting religious liberty. And most important for the Jews among us, America's problems are our problems. We are not living under the protection of a sovereign. We are part of the sovereign people by whose consent the government governs. And so a passive pessimism is not an option for us. As long as we are here, we need to do the work that will make Judaism flourish in the United States, and we need to do what we can as Jews and as Americans to make the United States flourish. So what does that entail? As citizens of this country, we have something to offer. We as Jews walk through the world with the conviction that the human being was created in goodness and in the image of God. And America needs that conviction right now, when so many of our citizens have lost faith that their neighbors are decent. We as Jews know how to disagree without fracturing. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel fought for generations and never stopped learning from each other. And America needs that model too, when political opponents have become enemies rather than fellow travelers. These are not small contributions. They are what a tradition that has thought seriously about human beings live together can offer a country that is struggling to remember how. And for our own community, our time in America should remind us that we need to be honest that Judaism is not simply an Enlightenment religion of universal values dressed in ancient garb. It's a covenant forged in dissent, anchored in a people. The same open America that forced us towards Avodah Me'ahava can also tempt us to dilute what is particular and demanding about who we are. And we must resist that. We must invest in learning, in translating those ideas to a broader audience, and in making the full depth of this tradition available to Jews who are choosing it and to others who may want to. But I think we will do all this work mainly by doubling down on Avodah Me'ahava, the mode that America taught us how to inhabit on an unprecedented scale. And here the Talmud offers a reminder of the potency of this mode of service, calling us to both optimism and a heightened sense of responsibility. Ma'ika bein oseh me'ahava le'oseh miyirah. What is the difference, really, between one who performs mitzvot out of love and one who does so out of fear? It's as we have learned. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, Gadol ha'oseh me'ahava yoter min ha'oseh miyirah. Greater is the one who acts out of love than the one who acts out of fear. For the one who acts out of fear is sustained for 1,000 generations, while the one who acts out of love is sustained for 2,000 generations. For here it says, La'alafim le'ohavai u'lashomrei mitzvotai, to thousands in the plural who love me and keep my commandments. And it is written here, u'lashomrei mitzvotav le'elef dor. And to those who keep God's commandments for 1,000 generations. 1,000 generations isn't bad, but the text is emphasizing that shmirat mitzvot, simply following the rules of the covenant, that will get you a good long run of chesed, of love manifest as kindness from God. But if you love the pathways of the covenant, you will get at least 2,000 generations of the same. Put another way, Avodah Me'ahava is a bigger lift, but it is much more durable. Train a people to manage to love God and Torah and Judaism in an environment where nothing is expected of you, and you will have created a near eternal bond that will last longer than you can imagine. I am not a politician, and though I am, in a sense, the son of a politician, I still don't pretend to know if America's best days are behind us. But I do know this. It would be best for Jews to hope that they are ahead of us. And as long as there is hope that they are, we must do our part to make it so. The basic value of hakarat hatov, of gratitude, ought to be enough to elicit this from us, given the ways in which America rewrote our Agadah of what the story of the world had to be. But more deeply, our own tradition tells us here in this text that when we build a culture of Avodah Me'ahava, we should be building on a scale that thinks in thousands of generations. The idea of America as we approach its 250th is too precious to see as simply another manifestation of the fourth kingdom. This is our democracy as much as anyone else's. And internalizing that should gear us up for at least another 250 years of answering Washington's call. May God imbue our hearts with the sense of purpose that will make us proud Jews who continue to do our part not only to benefit from, but to contribute to this great experiment of which we have been blessed to take part.